This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
We do not sit around tables in Washington and hold hands and sing Kumbaya and make change happen. That is not how it happens. It is counting votes. It is having difficult conversations. It is disciplining coalitions. And as long as you take off the rose-colored glasses and kind of put on the work goggles, you can see your way through to whatever vision you believe in.
On any given day in Washington, D.C., policy proposals are created, debated, and decimated by tens of thousands of people and organizations working behind the scenes. Each week, a guest and I will visit one of D.C.'s many watering holes and distill the art of advocacy. We'll pull back the curtain a bit and take a look at how they play their part in this sausage factory we call our federal government. So if you're at all interested in how the sausage is made, pull up a chair, grab a drink, and join us for the next 20 minutes or so. After all, what goes better with sausage than a tall, cold one? Welcome to this episode of 80 Proof Politics. We're broadcasting today from Supra, a restaurant at 11th and M Northwest in D.C. that just opened about a year and a half ago, but it's a wonderful contemporary design, great bar in the back of the restaurant that focuses on Georgian cuisine. And I'm not talking about fried chicken and Coca-Cola here, folks. This is the country of Georgia on the Black Sea, former Soviet bloc country. And if you take a look at the menu, I think you'd want to come back and try it again and again. They've got great items like duck breast, sausages, roasted eggplant, and these khachapuri, which are just various styles of cheese bread, which I think we could survive on. Oh, I think an order has just been placed. Well done. It is very much trying to capture the culture of the Georgian country. In fact, the word supra is a Georgian term for a feast with an abundance of food, flowing wine, typically hosted by a toastmaster called a tamada, who keeps the party going with jokes, stories, songs. I mean, I'm picturing a combination of a Greek wedding and an Irish wake without the guests of honor.
Sounds perfect.
It does sound really good. The owners, Jonathan and Laura Nelm, come by this naturally because they've had a longtime love of the Georgian culture and many things Russian in addition to that. In fact, with their daughters, lived in Moscow for 3 years. Is that right, Jonathan? Right. And then have replicated that experience in Supra. But Jonathan also comes by it naturally on his own because he was one of the first 50 American high school students to do the exchange program with Russia when the wall came down in 1989 and 1990. I highly recommend this place, and it was recommended to me by our guest expert today, Tom Sheridan, founder and president of the Sheridan Group. Tom, welcome and
welcome.
Cheers.
Thank you. Thanks for being here.
Thrilled to have
welcome
you.
Welcome to the neighborhood.
Now, Tom is one of the leading social advocates in town, has done this for a number of years, and many high-profile causes that I'm sure you'll be aware of. Has advocated on behalf of cancer funding for a number of groups. Was instrumental in the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act, has been engaged in global poverty issues, human trafficking issues, and most notably was the main engine, I think it's safe to say, behind the Ryan White Care Act, which is a great story I'm going to let you tell in just a little bit. But Tom has also recently published a new book called Helping the Good Do Better, How a White Hat Lobbyist Advocates for Social Change. And Tom, I got to tell you, I had a chance to read this book this weekend, and it is a great read for anyone who's interested in how Washington works, and particularly on how Washington can work for social causes and organizations. But you have a lot of great advice and a lot of good pithy quotes and tidbits that really cements the concept of being an advocate.
Thank you.
I'd like to ask you in particular about your distinction between a social activist and a social advocate.
So I think an activist is kind of raising the problem. And kind of bringing attention around the problem, trying to heighten the visibility, heighten the concern, heighten the crisis. I think a social advocate is the problem solver. It's the person that has to, you know, take that energy that the activist gins up. The person has to actually do the job of getting the deal done, getting the program created and or passed, is really the advocate. So we're on the more practical side of the equation, more of the technician, the both art and science professional that has to put those strategies together and then execute on them.
Is it hard to get activists to buy into that strategy?
Sometimes there's tension between them, and frankly, I think there should be. I actually like that tension. I find it helpful. I find tension on both the left and the right important. I call it my airplane theory.
Explain that, because you talk about that in the book. I think it's a great analogy.
So yeah, I created it the hard way during the middle of the AIDS lobby, which was quite difficult. I ACT UP on one side, and I had Jesse Helms and the Christian right wing on the right side. So I left ACT UP and right wing, and the tension between them, between them and through me, was intense.
Had to be palpable.
It was palpable, and sometimes really challenging. I mean, ACT UP locked me to my desk one day for the entire day. They picketed my house. They, you know, closed my garage. They closed me into the garage. They threw an ice cream cone on me at a march one day. Like, they were sometimes as angry at me as anybody else. But in the middle of that, my only way to make sense of it was that old thing about, you know, if both sides are mad at me, I must be doing something right.
Yeah.
I came to a comfortable place in that idea. And then that's where the airplane theory came from, which was, look, you need a left wing and a right wing to fly a plane. And it's the job of the social activist, the lobbyist, the advocate per se, to think of themselves as the pilot. So don't try and take your wings off. And that happens with progressives. You think, I have to quiet down my left side, or I have to control what the right wing is doing.
Or ignore one side.
Or ignore one side or the other. All of those are mistakes. The idea is, use the tension, use the physics that's created in that moment to actually find your way to the middle. And particularly when social unrest is part of the dynamic of a movement, politicians are forced to try and quell it. And it pushes people to this place called the middle, and there's a lot of work that can be done there.
One of the things that struck me in how you have approached that over your years here in Washington has been through coalition building.
Yeah.
And that's a real art form, and that has to be a constant hand-holding process. But I thought, tell us a bit about your experience with One Voice Against Cancer, because that seemed like the perfect opportunity and probably a big challenge in putting a coalition together and keeping it together.
Well, first and most importantly about coalitions, that people have to realize, particularly in progressive coalitions, that doesn't mean everyone gets along. And sometimes getting a coalition together, the first big hurdle is the fact that they're not getting along. Frequently, they are competitors. And the cancer lobby was the One Voice Against Cancer effort was a really good example of that. I stepped into that space in the midst of what we call the body part wars. So if breast cancer got money, prostate cancer was mad. If brain cancer got money, pancreatic cancer was mad. Everybody was mad at everybody else, and they were really honestly competing against each other. I stepped into the middle of that and said, you can compete against each other, but you're going nowhere. In fact, you're kind of going down. They had been mad at me for a number of years because I was the AIDS lobbyist, and I would walk into the Appropriations Committee and kind of walk in with 100 national groups behind me, argue for my dollars, usually get them, and I'd be out the door. And they were still in the hallway fighting with each other with no consensus, no agreements, nothing. So when I approached them, I'm like, that's, you have to do that. Then once we got to that space where it was a necessity for them, and it really did become a necessity, the most important about coalitions that I find, and we won't organize them anymore without this discipline behind it, everybody has to agree on the goal.
Okay.
If you agree on the goal, the process to get there becomes ordered and disciplined, and it's kind of worth it to go through the struggles to make those things happen. It's a lot of hard work. It's a lot of compromises. It's hand-holding. It's fighting. It's all those things. But when you're agreeing on the goal, you're pushing toward the goal. What happens in a lot of coalitions is they lose sight of their goal. They wound up in process. They wound up as a kind of a, you know, the circular firing squad. And they're very busy debating and fighting with each other, and they never actually get out of the room and get to the place that's most important. And in this case, that's Capitol Hill and up onto the Appropriations Committee or an Authorizing Committee.
When you talk about agreeing to the goal, do you find you have to move a bit from the lofty goal to the practical goal?
Always. And, you know, coalitions are just good practice for doing that, because Congress is going to require that anyway. Like, if you're not into compromise, if that's not what you want to do, do not go into the legislative court to get your work done. It is ultimately a game of compromise. The game gets played well when you know you're going into compromise. So I always go in with a big fat cake with a ton of whipped cream on top. And I know exactly where I'm going to shape that whipped cream from. I know exactly how far I'm willing to go before I get to the point where the cake's compromised. And then you stop there. But it is important to know that. If you're not going in with the idea of compromise, you're not likely to be successful. Coalitions are a really good way to begin to practice that art of compromise. And it makes you tougher and stronger and more effective when you do get into the legislative body. And this, by the way, this matters. This really works on Capitol Hill, but it also works in City Hall. It also works in the State House. It works in any. It works at a zoning board. The same coalition rules apply no matter which place you're playing in the public policy arena.
So, keeping with the pastry analogy, you have a phrase in here that's along those same lines. Yeah. I think you've talked about keeping the goal in mind, sticking to the goal. But the phrase you use is "bake a bigger pie; slices are up for grabs." Explain that.
So in the not-for-profit world, we like to call a lot of our colleagues kind of co-opetition with each other. So they are co-opetition. They are cooperating around the problem, the disease, the social problem that they're trying to solve. There's cooperation around it. But really, at a fundamental level, they also are competitive. They compete against each other for philanthropy. They compete against each other for federal grants and contracts. There's a lot of competition that goes on in the progressive social interest community. And what we like to do is just embrace it, is to say, we know you're going to be competitive. We know you are competitive. But that can either be your weakness or it can be your strength. And what I like to do is kind of turn that around a little bit and talk about using your co-opetition as a strength in the way you build your political strategy. We recognize that you will be competitive and we want you to be competitive, but don't you want to compete for more as opposed to less? So if you can check your competition, get to cooperation, particularly at the political levels, the opportunity to compete for bigger pieces of the pie are there. And the One Voice Against Cancer example is a perfect example. Over the course of the 10 plus years I worked with them, they had more than 1,000% increase in federal funding for cancer. Mm-hmm. When people are dividing up 1,000% more, they are a lot nicer to each other and a lot more effective, in the way they, and we're rewarded. I mean, that's how staying in the coalition became the reward for being able to, check some of your competition, check some of your ego, check some of your rage. I mean, disease lobbies particularly, people are dying. It brings anger, it brings rage, it brings a lot of emotion, and you have to have a way to handle that, how to unpack it, how to store it, how to diffuse it when necessary, and the coalition model of co-opetition kind of helps me help them do that a little better.
Have you ever had to kick anybody out of a coalition?
Yes.
That has to be extremely difficult.
It is very difficult to do it, and there are consequences for doing it. But I tell people this all the time, I would rather have a coalition of a few that are focused and disciplined about what they want than a coalition of hundreds that keep you at the lowest common denominator. Mm-hmm. And it is a frequent fault, and I see it a lot, where coalitions will move consensus to the point of almost being irrelevant in the solution to their problem because they don't want to lose anybody on the way there. I don't value that. If the coalition isn't promoting the highest common denominator, it isn't actually valuable for the members, and it's certainly not valuable for me to be working on it. You don't need me to boil down something to a toothless resolution. Like, anyone can do that, and Congress is more than happy to pass it and say they did a good job recognizing your problem. That's the worst value, but a common mistake, a common problem in coalitions.
So I'm curious how you, and I know there's no template necessarily or one-size-fits-all approach to this, but now once you get this coalition built and you've agreed on a goal, you have to implement some tactics to get that ultimate goal accomplished, particularly here in Capitol Hill or within an administration. What are some, pull on one of your examples and give us some a sense of the tools you do use in that.
So normally what I ask in coalitions, because in the not-for-profit space, rarely is there money, real money on the table. So what we rely on is in-kind support. So I say to people, look, there's no free rides. No one's coming to this coalition meeting to write your newsletter, and then we're never going to see you on Capitol Hill. So we schedule meetings. I say everybody, every Thursday afternoon for the next 6 weeks, everybody's giving me your schedule. I have control over you from 1 o'clock in the afternoon till 6 o'clock at night.
This is sweat equity.
It's sweat equity, and everybody shows up, and I take names and attendance. I was raised by nuns, so I'm really good at the, you know, taking names and attendance. I know who's there, and I know who's not. And it is when people don't show up, they don't do their fair share, that you discipline folks for doing that. And it is hard to do it, but frankly, once you've done it, coalitions are then paying attention to you in a very different way. So I always tell people, if you're hiring me to be Miss Congeniality, you hired the wrong guy. I'm much more the nun. There are rules, there's discipline, you got to show up, you got to do your work. Right. No rulers.
she, my wife, I had a wrist when I said that. So you have to create this strategy. You have tools to move forward. You talk about this in the book, and it resonated very well with me because there's a political scientist by the name of John Kingdon who talks about the three fluxes of policy creation. You have to have all three of his elements to be successful at policy creation, and those three are a recognized problem, an offered solution to the problem, and the ability to move the political will. Now, you talk about that in a little bit of a different sense, but it echoed with
it's
me.
Very similar.
The three Ps.
Three Ps, yeah. So my three Ps are, I combine the first two of John's into one called policy. Okay. So you have to have both a problem and a solution. You have to have both.
Yep.
The second thing you have to have is politics, and that's people. It's the power of people to use their citizenship in an effective, disciplined, and passionate manner. I mean, I'm a big believer, and I say this all the time to people, politics is ultimately a game of passion. So you need those passionate people. That's your politics, particularly for the not-for-profit sector. We don't have money or PACs or those kind of things to really deal with. Then the last piece is press. The newer one for me is press.
Yeah.
And that's how the community writ large endorses your problem or your view of the problem. They are basically saying your problem is a priority and your solution is an imperative. So when you get the editorial board of your newspaper to agree with you, to call on Congress to do a better job, when you get a feature article, you know, focusing on both the problem and the solution you're offering, when you get the press involved, you get a much broader group of people committed to it and agreeing with you. It's your hallelujah chorus behind you.
So the press is not the end game.
The press is not the end game. It never is, and I know my friends in the communications field get mad at me when I say that. I get a lot of feedback when they say press is a tactic, it's not a strategy.
Well put.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Well, what has been, now you, as I mentioned at the outset, you've been involved in a number of high-profile social causes that have been highly successful. What prompted you to set up the Sheridan Group?
So I just finished almost five years at the AIDS Lobby. So I ran the domestic AIDS Lobby out of AIDS Action Council for almost 5 years. And it was some of the best work I ever done, but it was also some of the most exhausting work I'd ever done. And I found myself at 30 years old really thinking I'm going to burn out if I stay in single-issue politics. Single-issue politics has real advantages, and it was a great gift to have done that as a young person, but it has real disadvantages too. You can stay in that tank for too long, and it changes you. And sometimes it doesn't change you for the better. And I kind of just knew that. I went with my partner, my now husband, to Africa for my 30th birthday. I had this dream of hiking Kilimanjaro since I was a kid.
Wow.
And everyone thought I was nuts, particularly my parents. And they're like, what? I went to Africa and hiked Kilimanjaro. And literally at the top of Kilimanjaro, I said to myself, I'm going home. And I've got to figure out something else to do. I have to figure out a way to leave work. Yeah. But I didn't want to leave. I wanted to leave the single issue, but I didn't want to leave the work because I thought we just created something that no one thought was possible. We took really dust and created a sphinx out of it. So I didn't want that experience to be lost, and I didn't want the the energy, the enthusiasm, the strategy to go kind of away. So what I thought I would just do is come back and say any group that looked like and felt like what the AIDS lobby was 5 years before could come to me, and I couldn't do the same thing. It's a different thing, but I could use their assets as creatively and as effectively as I did for the AIDS community, and then build them something that would actually be effective. So it really started out as an idea to do something for a little while. I was actually hoping to go home to run for Congress in New York, and so the idea was to do it as a consultant, because it would leave me a little bit more money than I was making, obviously, at AIDS Action Council, potentially more money. So my goal was to bank a year's worth of salary in a year, and then go home and run in the 1994 congressional midterm elections, which is the election Clinton got crushed in.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so, you were against the wave. Yeah.
Way against the wave. And I wound up not running, but that was the intention. So the Sheridan Group was, like, people say, what was your business plan? I'm like, well, I'm an MSW, not an MBA. I didn't have one, is the truth of it. We did not even have a marketing strategy for really the first 10 years of the firm. We never wanted to be, I never wanted to be big. It was always really important for me. My father was a small businessman.
Okay.
And he said to me when I opened the firm that the one thing you should never do is create an overhead that forces you to take business you don't want. And so I just kept that in my head the whole time, which is I wanted to do the quality work I wanted to do. And, you know, we only grew to that size, and we only staffed to those kind of imperatives. So we never, you know, real estate, I mean, I own the building where the office is now because, honestly, I was too cheap to pay rent, and it was too expensive. I never wanted to be K Street. I always kind of wanted to be M Street or something a little off the beaten track. It's kind of both our reputation and our culture. So it was, we have a very, we once had a class of MBA students, you know, come in and do a project around us, and basically, you know, they got an A, but I got an F.
I like that a lot. So you've obviously made a good business out of it. What has been, it seems too easy to ask you the most rewarding cause that you're involved in, because they all seem extremely rewarding.
Yeah, it's like picking your children. You can't choose favorites.
How would you do that? But which was the most challenging?
The most challenging?
In terms of maybe the goal and the strategy to get there.
You know, I actually think the international AIDS epidemic with Bono was the most challenging. And it's interesting because they had more assets. They had the world's biggest rock star, right, as an asset. But how to use them and when to use them and how not to overuse them. And how to, you know, he was Irish and not American, so the political fodder there was honestly limited. And the problem was so big.
Yes.
That it felt like, you know, it felt like trying to boil the ocean.
Yeah.
And Bono, you know, he wanted poverty and AIDS linked. And, you know, when I first sat down with him, I was like those are two almost too big in and of themselves problems to take on. So figuring out a way to build that, and, you know, international spending, international development issues are the hardest issues to bring to the American public.
Yes.
People have a lot of myths about how much we spend and whether we should, and is, you know, particularly right now with America First mentality, it's hard to get those issues moving forward. You don't have, for my work as a not-for-profit, what I always have is I always have constituents in the domestic place. I always have, you know, people who are, you know, getting services from those programs. Our family members at the disability community, nothing better than a disability community with parent-driven advocacy. They're fierce. I had none of those assets going into creating the One campaign. And building it, creating it, and doing it around the complexities of working with a rock star, both with his assets, but also with the liabilities that came with it, that was really challenging.
Once you got past, once you realized it was Bono and not Bon Jovi.
Yes, an embarrassing story about my cultural relevance, but yes, true.
Once you got... once you got past the fact that he is a rock star, that he is a global icon, he's a one-name person.
Right.
How did you find working with him in terms of the best way to utilize his time, his energy, and his enthusiasm?
You know, thank God. I mean, this is Providence more than anything else, but we never had a disagreement about that issue. He didn't want to be used as a celebrity, but he knew he could use his celebrity.
Yeah.
But he really did not want that model. He wanted to be smart. He wanted to be thoughtful. He wanted to bring a level of commitment and a sustainable sense of energy to the table. So he started in the right spot. He'd done the debt relief campaign before he and I worked together in 2000. So he had an idea of what that felt like. But he also had an idea when you're working on a debt relief. It was a 2000 initiative, as a millennial initiative. He knew that this was not going to be a one-off. You weren't going to. It wasn't like an election where you're going to win on a certain day or lose on a certain day. Mm-hmm. He knew that this had to be built over time. And he wanted people to respect him for his passion for the issue and his credibility on the substance first, before he put himself out there. So we spent 3 years working on the issues and the ideas, what became PEPFAR, what became the Global Fund. Mm-hmm. We spent 3 years incubating those issues amongst ourselves and talking about them quietly in small meetings on Capitol Hill where we didn't do any press or any visibility. He went very humbly and said, tell me what I need to know and do to be effective in your space.
So learning the process.
Learning the
Washington.
Process, yeah. I don't That's know if I wrote this. I can't remember if I wrote this in the book, but he walked into Pat Leahy's office one day, or really early in the process, and he said to Leahy, who's Elvis? And Leahy's like, what? Yeah. Are you talking about? Like, who's Elvis? And he didn't. And so Bono's like, who's the guy? Like, who do I have to, like, talk to? And Leahy, like, schooled him on, like, we're all Elvis.
Yeah.
You know, at the end of the day, everyone thinks, every senator thinks of themselves as the Elvis.
Yeah. And
for Bono, that was a really remarkable moment. Like, he sincerely wanted to learn. And by the way, is wicked smart and a really quick learner. And then very people savvy.
So I would characterize that as kind of the glam side of what you've been doing. All right? But you talk in your book about a lot of things that happened that are far from that.
They're far from that.
Right. And oftentimes the decisions have to be made as a legislation is moving through, as a budget line is threatened, that aren't always pretty, and they're really hard to do. And oftentimes you have to be creative to come up with a solution for that. I'd love for you to tell the story about the funding formula for AIDS care in the Kennedy bill.
Yeah. So, there's a lot of mythology around how this stuff gets done. So here's the non-myth side of that story. So we were trying to create a bill in the middle of the AIDS crisis that would get money as quickly and as effectively to the most affected places in the country. So we went to a CDC document called the MMWR that said how many cases of AIDS were reported in those cities and states and how many people had died. And we basically said, is there a threshold by which we can define the hardest hit places? We decided that we were going to go with a disaster relief idea.
Yeah,
that
so a FEMA-like approach.
A FEMA-like approach. Right? Okay. So we're like, we have to treat this like we would treat another natural disaster, but in this case, it's a public health disaster. So we were like, okay, so when you do that, you have to find location. So how do you define what a disaster is and where it is? And when we went through the first chunk of those cities, there were five at the top of the list, none of which was Boston. And I was pretty clear that we weren't going to do this bill unless Ted Kennedy. We had no friends at that. In this moment, it is 1988. Yeah. Nancy Pelosi had just gotten to Congress. She and Barbara Boxer were my two friends on the. Thank God I had these friends. But with my two friends on the House side, and Ted Kennedy and Daniel Patrick Moynihan were my friends on the Senate side.
Yeah.
So, out of a hard count of 535, I had four. I had a great four. But I tell young people doing this, like, never underestimate, even when the numbers are small, look at the quality of that number and decide whether you have something that's worth working with. I knew we weren't going to, I could not ask Ted Kennedy to do what I knew was in a ginormous lift legislatively to really put the first historic piece of AIDS legislation out there. Mm-hmm. Nancy Pelosi got reprimanded by the leadership of the House for saying the word AIDS on the floor.
Is that right?
That year. So, like, we were not, I mean, it's hard to believe how bad it was then, but it was awful. So I just said to the group I was working with, eight service organizations, one of which was a group called AIDS Action in Boston.
Yeah.
I'm like, Boston has to be on the table. And Larry, who was at the table that day, was like, yeah, Boston's got to be at the table. I'm like, Larry, it's not really about you. It's like, Kennedy has to, you know, he has to have something politically that makes sense to him in this bill. And so Boston was number 10. So the first 10 cities in the country that were included in Ryan White included the city of Boston, and that's why the number and the threshold was chosen as it was. Now, I've been to training sessions all over the country where people are training on Ryan White, and I've listened to professors who have done, you know, academic studies in this, no offense to, you know, your Archer friends, I've done it, and they go wax and wane about, you know, it must have been a combination of these factors weighted against these dynamics, and I'm like, nope, it was Boston, and everything about Boston got in on the list.
I would love for you to also explain this phrase you use a number of times in the book, which rings so true. Your thank-spank approach to dealing with Congress.
So the thank-and-spank is you have to be relevant in order for anyone to pay attention to you on Capitol Hill or in any other political environment. And again, this zoning boards, you know, city halls, state houses, it's the same thing. You have to be relevant. And then people have pushed me over the years to say, well, what does relevant mean? And I boiled relevant down to meaning thank and spank, which is that if you don't have the ability to reward people for doing the right thing or punish them for doing the wrong thing, and you know, you could say that in a fancy way, like accountability matters. But if you don't have that factor, why should anyone, and particularly on issues I've worked on, like very hard issues, controversial issues, you know, nascent issues that don't have big lobbies or, you know, lots of political power immediately at their disposal, you have to have something that says there's a consequence for you not paying attention to this.
Yeah.
And if you're not thinking about that and you're not honestly articulating it in a respectful way, not in a threatening way, but in a respectful, mature way, mm-hmm. people are not paying attention to you.
So what are some spank examples you've had to use over the years?
Well, there's a lot of them over the years, but during the anti-tobacco lobby, which is did not make the cut for the editing of the book, sadly, but during the anti-tobacco lobby that I ran, we really had a difficult time with bipartisan members of Congress, and particularly leadership folks, because the tobacco lobby was so strong and so rich.
Yeah.
And people literally could just pay their way through hard votes because we were just a public health community and we were never going to do anything. So we got one particular funder to let me run newspaper ads, and we basically took all the leadership of the House and Senate, bipartisan, and we said, when the country was asked, whose side were you on, will it be, and we drew a line down this full-page newspaper ad, Big Tobacco, and put the logos of the big tobacco companies, or kids, and we put pictures of kids, and it was the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids was the coalition that we were running.
Right.
But we put the question to them publicly, we will hold you accountable for having answered this question. Who did you side with when the health of the nation was at risk? Big tobacco or kids? And it really pissed off the leadership on both sides. On both sides of the aisle, they were really mad. Which is you're playing hardball. And I was like, and one particular friend who was in leadership at the time was really mad at me about it because I ran it in his newspaper in his state, in his hometown. Like, how dare you run that ad against me? That's a threat. And I'm like, do you know who I'm up against? I was like, are you kidding me? You're like, I'm up against the tobacco lobby.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not going to play softball.
So could you track the accountability measure? Could you see if they would change their position?
Or? So we did find that when we said we will go public with this, we will run ads like this against you in your district. We will make this an issue for voters. We got a lot of people who wanted to do the right thing but didn't have any incentive to do it by showing them what that spank might potentially look like. We lost that debate, as you may remember. We lost it on a technicality. We lost it in a filibuster. We could not break the filibuster that Mitch McConnell led. But we broke all but two of the Republicans we needed to get that voting. So we lost by two, which for the public health community, at that moment, the public health community up against the tobacco industry. Mm. We had a 9-week debate on the Senate floor, the longest Senate floor debate other than the Civil Rights Act of 67, is the longest one ever. We were on the floor for 9 weeks. And sustaining in that 9 weeks was, like I lived at a Holiday Inn on Capitol Hill.
Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really, I think I maybe went home twice the whole time that was going on. And it was
coordinating tag team politics,
everything
for
right.
the floor.
For floor, yeah, and you know, votes and amendments and second degree amendments, and it was exhausting.
Sure was.
And probably the most exhausting of all the things I've done over the almost 30 years I've been doing this. That was an amazing one, but it was really hard to lose on a technicality, and we lost for money. So what McConnell said to those guys was, I will pay for ads that will help you inoculate yourself against these public health folks. And I did go to the public health community. We had a war room meeting a week before that vote, and I said, if we can come up with $500,000 and threaten to run ads of our own using the American Cancer Society's logo, the American Heart Association's logo, use your brand, against their brand. And, you know, and $500,000 was nothing compared to what the tobacco industry was spending and willing to spend. But if we had it, and we could at least threaten it, I thought we could get to those two votes. I knew we could get those two. They were both vulnerable reelect members.
So in the end, they spanked your spank.
They spanked. They out-trumped my spank. Yeah. But you know what? The story there is there's great wisdom in losing.
Well, I want to circle back in as we wind down our episode here and ask you about how you got started. Because you mentioned that you have a master's in social work.
I do, yeah.
So you were a social worker by training.
Yes.
You had an idea to do what with that?
So my first
not to come to Washington and not to run
your own. My first job was working with adolescents. My first internship was working with adolescent schizophrenics in a state psychiatric hospital.
Okay.
And I realized 6 weeks into it that I was going to do no good for nobody in that situation. I was, you know, unlocking doors, going into day rooms where people were mostly drugged and were likely to spend the rest of their lives. And these institutions were honestly horrific. So I decided that was not going to be what I wanted to do. But I happened to have met another social worker who took a job working to deinstitutionalize people coming out of institutions for the mentally retarded in New York after deinstitutionalization. So she had she said, you know, come work with me. And my first job was to work on the zoning boards because we couldn't get the group homes open unless we got the zoning boards to agree. And the first zoning board was happened to have been in my hometown.
Okay.
So
this was what caused
that's what created the politics. And it caused my mother to shop in New Jersey for a number of years,
exactly right.
Which I didn't know about for years until years later, until I went home to run for Congress. And she's like, you cannot do that because I cannot keep shopping in New Jersey. And I'm like, what? Are you talking about?
So you go from zoning board to D.C.?
I went to zoning board to D.C.
No,
there wasn't the zone. Well, we got the houses open,
okay.
And we were really successful, and I loved my job. And Ronald Reagan got elected president. And he basically went through a series of budget cuts that basically collapsed the entire social. We built a house out of a house of cards,
right.
Social programs, right? So it was, you know, food stamps was our food budget, and you know, CETA, the old work program, was where the residents worked in community jobs. So the whole thing was hobbled together. And Reagan came in and blew the house of cards straight down in his first budget. And we organized.
Okay.
And I got the residents and the staff and the family and friends of everybody that were in those houses. And we went to our congressman's office and we kind of raised hell. And we brought the press with us. And there's my pee. And we brought the press with us. And it rattled the congressman. Badly, and this is when we had moderate Republicans.
Right. World.
Well, this is Ben Gilman.
Like
right.
Oh,
so
sure.
The same
as
Hudson River Valley. So the neighboring congressional district was Ben Gilman. And it rattled them badly. And we were able to kind of create this energy, and we were able to push back pretty effectively, and we got a bunch of Republicans to push back on those budget cuts, and we saved those programs. The threats continued through through every administration, Republican administration, since we've faced these kind of draconian ideas of social policy spending and cutting, but we were successful. And the National Association of Social Workers, for some reason, was paying attention. And they basically said, we have a fellowship, one student can come to the national headquarters and you can do whatever you want for the year, and we will pay you to do it, which was interesting, and we will provide your master's program, as long as you qualify for a master's program in Washington, D.C. So they put a package together. It was the offer you couldn't refuse. It was the offer my parents said I couldn't refuse. So I packed my bags and moved to D.C.
That's great. So the fellowship lasted 1 year.
1 year.
And then did you find, did you go to AIDS Action from there?
No.
Okay.
So the fellowship was, I created a political action committee for the National Association of Social Workers.
Oh.
My last project before ending it was to give them a presidential endorsement process to go through. I mimicked it on NEA.
Mm-hmm.
The National Education Association had a really good one at the time. I was talking to the Mondale for president, the first campaign, the political director for Mondale, about how to do delegate selection. He said to me, I had applied for the Peace Corps and gotten in, so that's what I was going to do after the fellowship. I was talking to Paul Tully about delegate selection one day, and he said, what are you doing when you graduate? And I said, I'm going to the Peace Corps. I'm going to Africa or El Salvador, depending on how good my Spanish wasn't. And that was it. He said, well, why would you work in a foreign country when you can help save America? And I'm like, well, what are you talking about saving America? He's like, you're always talking about how much you know, dislike Ronald Reagan and his policies. He said, Walter Mondale's going to beat Ronald Reagan, and you can work for him. And I was like, well, what does that mean? And he said, I'll give you $15 a day, and you're leaving for Iowa. like next week, like the week after you graduate. And I did. I said yes. Really made my parents angry.
Oh, sure.
But I said yes, and I went to Iowa, Maine, Wyoming, Oklahoma, Kansas. I traveled all over the country organizing for Walter Mondale. And so that's where the politics really got steeped.
What was a typical day like on that? You were organizing people to come out for rallies, to turn out the vote?
No, caucus goers, turning out the vote.
Caucus in Iowa.
But like, I'm a kid from New York, right? So, and I'm, born in the Bronx, raised just north. Like, I didn't really realize what an agricultural economy looked like. I was also a vegetarian at the time. My first event with Walter Mondale was the Hormel meatpacking plant in Sioux City, Iowa. Very disturbing.
Yeah.
When people say about politics, watching sausage get made is a difficult thing to do, I actually did it. It's really difficult to do it.
That's the Where's the Beef campaign, isn't it?
It was Where's the Beef.
Say that ties
exactly.
All
exactly. I did not come up with that line, Mondale. That was all his. It had nothing to do with me. It certainly opened your eyes in both the best ways. Like when you have to talk to people, caucus goers in Iowa, about what their life is really like, and you're living with them for 3 or 4 months, as I did, you really get to know that politics is very personal.
So, Tom, in conclusion, what kind of advice would you give to someone who wants to come to town and make a difference, someone who maybe has been a social activist and sees the value of being the advocate now? What should they do?
So the first and most important piece of advice I would give to somebody is to not get trapped into the you're too young space. And it is frequently said, but change comes mostly from young people and is mostly coming from young people. And I think what happens is Washington is this intimidating place where everyone pretends really you have to be in the UPS model. You got to go start at the ground floor and work your way up. And you know, there's truth to that in terms of jobs, but there's not actually truth to that in terms of activism. So the first thing is do not believe it. If somebody says you're too young, because frankly, when you're too young, it's when you're willing to take those big risks. It's when you're kind of maybe too not smart enough to know better that you're going to do the bolder, bigger, riskier, more innovative idea that actually winds up being the big success. So I tell people a lot, if you have an idea, if you're at your highest moment in passion and concern about an issue, or at your lowest moment of passion and concern about an issue, that's a good time to start. Don't wait to start. Starting is a moment. My grandmother used to tell us that starting was half finished. That's how she got us to do chores, right? So just start and then you're half finished. So it gives you a more optimistic way to look at a challenge, right? But I just tell people to start, and to start from that place that is passionate and that's thoughtful and that really wants to make a difference, and let their chips then, let that become the educational environment for you. You will learn a lot. You will fail a little, maybe even a lot along the way, but it is the starting and then the learning that becomes the most important element of whether you're going to be successful or not. The second thing I tell people is to be really disciplined, is that this is not something, we do not sit around tables in Washington and hold hands and sing Kumbaya and make change happen. Yeah. That is not how it happens. It is counting votes. It is having difficult conversations. It is disciplining coalitions. The hard work of it is, and that's why I wrote the book, is to let people know that this is possible. It's very doable, but there's really hard work and discipline and strategy that you have to bring to the table. And as long as you take off the rose-colored glasses and kind of put on the work goggles, you can see your way through to whatever vision you believe in.
Well, that is sound advice. And I wish you all the luck in the world on
the
book. Again, it's called Helping the Good Do Better, How a White Hat Lobbyist Advocates for Social Change. I checked on this on the way here today. You can find it on Amazon as of this week.
And it's number one in philanthropy and charities this morning.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And with that's all the time we have on this episode of 80 Proof Politics. Remember, no matter what you think of the current state of politics in Washington, whether you think the glass is half full or half empty, there's still room to fill your drink. Tom, thanks again.
Great. Cheers. Thank you. Let's have another one.
Hello, this is Gary Chachot welcoming you to check out the French History Podcast. Our main show covers the history of France from the first humans until present. If you liked Mike Duncan's The History of Rome and wanted a similar program covering the land of beauty, culture, and love, we are exactly that. We also host world-renowned scholars who have delivered guest episodes on their specialties, including 18th century pirates, revolutionary booksellers in 20th century Paris, the special friendship between the Marquis de Lafayette and Thomas Jefferson, and numerous others. Learn what you love and listen to the French History Podcast today.